All right. Well, without further ado, we're going to jump into our morning program. Actually, there is a bit of further ado because one thing we usually say at the start of this conference is we tell you a little bit about what the Federalist Society is. Many of you are members. Some of you are not. We have guest speakers and maybe members of the press. And I'll take just 1 minute, which is not CLE credit, to kind of explain what the society is. We're an organization of over 40,000 lawyers and law students. Law students founded this organization at three law schools in 1982. I won't name those law schools. But it was founded by law students who believed that from their experience in school, they were not getting the full story, that one ideology was sort of being imposed upon them by their professors and was taking hold among the student body and then in the legal profession. And so since that time, it's grown into not just having student chapters, but also having lawyers chapters. There are now in-house counsel groups, professor groups, practice areas. Go on the website. It's all on there. But I want to emphasize this before we move on to our first program. How does the Federalist Society carry out its mission? It carries out its mission by sponsoring debate, by sponsoring debates and speakers. Now, the focus of these debates, and it's about every area of policy and law that you can think about, but the overall point is that we can enhance individual freedom and enhance the rule of law and make sure that courts are constrained to their proper role by simply talking about these principles in an open way. The society is not about endorsing any candidate. Every now and then you may see a candidate who's an office holder or something at one of our events, but it's a rarity because we are not here to endorse anyone. We're not here to lobby for any issues. We're not even here to write amicus briefs. You will not see a Federalist Society amicus brief filed. You won't ever see that happen because we're not out there to propose ideas. We're here to debate. So in that very spirit, our very first panel, and I'm going to introduce not our panelists, but just our moderator, who I think needs an introduction. I'm going to give her an introduction. But sometimes we even come up and we give positions that we ourselves don't believe, but we've researched them just like you're mooting something for an argument. And so I'll be playing some of that role today here on Rule 8.4G, and we'll see if I can convince you of the other side here along with one of the other panelists. Okay, without further ado, Karen Donnelly, if you could come up here. Karen is the incoming president of the Kansas City Lawyers Chapter. She'll be taking over from me. Her practice focuses on First Amendment litigation and regulatory law in the areas of charitable, political, and commercial speech. She represents nonprofit and commercial entities within the fundraising, advertising, and marketing communities, including state AG investigations, FTC investigations, IRS audits, multi-state investigations, and civil rights litigation, and she has an appellate practice. In fact, she filed an amicus brief in the AFP versus Bonta case and represented 123 nonprofits and the Association of Fundraising Professionals. Here is her Law Review article from 2010 in the UMKC Law Review. Just listen to this title. Good governance: has the IRS usurped the business judgment of tax-exempt organizations in the name of transparency and accountability? That was 13 years ago, and we're still doing this today. In her practice, she counsels on the formation and advice to nonprofit groups. Personally, she's involved in a variety of organizations, serves on her pastoral council at St. Anthony's Parish in Kansas City, and lives in the historic Old Northeast neighborhood of the city, where she's going to be hosting our holiday party this coming December. So without further ado, Karen Donnelly, and remember, log in now on your card for our Rule 8.4 time.
Thank you, Eddie. Would you like us all to take our seats?
Yeah.
Okay. We have a little bit different setup this year. So I'm going to start by saying good morning. Thank you, Eddie, for the introduction. I would like to start by introducing our esteemed panelists today and then talk very briefly about the topic before turning it over. First, I'd like to introduce Theodore Frank. Ted Frank is the director of the Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute and the Center for Class Action Fairness. Ted founded and ran CCAF as a nonprofit public interest law firm in 2009. Ted has won a number of landmark appeals and tens of millions of dollars for consumers and other plaintiffs through his class action work. Adam Liptak of the New York Times calls Frank the leading critic of abusive class action settlements. Prior to founding CCAF, Ted clerked for the Honorable Frank H. Easterbrook on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and was a litigator at firms in Washington and Los Angeles, and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ted is a frequent public speaker and testified before Congress multiple times on legal issues. He has been profiled by the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, GQ, the ABA Journal, among other publications. Ted was elected to membership in the American Law Institute in 2008, and he serves on the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society Litigation Practice Group. Ted graduated from the University of Chicago Law School in 1994 with high honors and is a member of the Order of the Coif and the Law Review. He is a member of the District of Columbia Bar and the State Bars of California and Illinois. Thank you, Ted. I'd like to introduce Edward Grime. Eddie, you just met, is a partner at Graves Garrett in Kansas City. Eddie focuses his practice on complex commercial litigation, free speech, and election law, and internal investigation and whistleblower claims. He has been recognized for his successful representation of businesses and individuals in commercial litigation, and he is a go-to lawyer on constitutional and policy matters. Eddie was named a constitutional and election law trailblazer by the National Law Journal in 2020. His free speech and election law practice has included numerous constitutional challenge of election and campaign finance laws, representation of clients in state and federal ethics and campaign finance enforcement actions and investigations, advice and litigation regarding First Amendment protections for initiative petition drafting and circulation, litigation of state and federal redistricting issues, and representation of not-for-profit clients before state regulators and with regard to campaign and election law compliance. Eddie is a recognized appellate attorney and has argued before numerous courts of appeal across the country, both state and federal. Eddie received his law degree from Harvard Law School in 2002, where he taught on the Board of Student Advisors, received the Dean's Award for Leadership, and served as president of the Harvard Catholic Law Students Association. Eddie is a member of the Bars of Missouri, Kansas, and New York. And turning now to Kelly Frickleton. Kelly is an associate at Bartimus Frickleton Robertson Rader. Since joining the firm in 2017, Kelly has focused her practice on complex personal injury cases, including medical malpractice and insurance bad faith litigation and appeals. Kelly has spent considerable time studying the intersection of law and race, which culminated in 2019 with the presentation of an exploration of segregation in Kansas City at KCMBA's Bench Bar and Boardroom Conference. Relevant to today's panel, Kelly recently published an article in KC Counselor titled Words Matter, which discusses the importance of using inclusive language in the legal profession. Kelly currently serves KCMBA and the KCMBF as chair of the YLS Board CLE Committee, vice chair of the Student Law Committee, and an advisor and member of the Bar Leadership Academy Task Force and Communications Advisory Committee. She is also a member of the Association for Women Lawyers of Greater Kansas City, American Association for Justice, MATA, and the Women's Foundation. Kelly received her law degree from the University of Denver in 2017. Now, turning to our topic today, the question presented to our panel today is whether the failure to use inclusive language may violate the rules of professional conduct in certain circumstances. A secondary question, if we have time, is whether applying these rules in certain circumstances is constitutional. What is inclusive language? As Kelly will explain in more detail, she noted in her article that inclusive language is a communication style that incorporates phrases and expressions that are inherently welcoming. An example from Kelly's article, describing someone as formerly incarcerated rather than labeling them a convict or a criminal. Another example, would be abandoning the term Chinese wall, which is often used to describe ethical screening practices within law firms. The speakers here today will be considering the question of whether different contexts and settings lead to different answers or results under the rules and under the Constitution. The particular rule at stake is Rule 8.4G, although the speakers may address other rules as relevant. In 1998, the ABA promulgated a new Comment 3, which advised that some types of conduct that manifest bias or prejudice could violate Rule 8.4D, which prohibits conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. It was limited to conduct in representing a client. Model Rule 8.4G was promulgated by the ABA only in 2016. The ABA cited the need for a cultural shift as the reason for the rule. The model rule expands the old comment and now makes bias and prejudice a direct violation of a separate rule, and no longer requires that the bias either one, prejudice the administration of justice, or two, occur within a client representation. Only two states have fully adopted it, but many others, including Pennsylvania and Missouri, adopted versions of it. One of our speakers, Ted Frank, mounted a First Amendment overbreath and vagueness challenge to Pennsylvania's version shortly after its Supreme Court adopted the rule in 2020. His case focuses on the rule's application to attorney speech and CLE programming. The case is now pending before the Third Circuit. Today, we will address a topic that is both broader and narrower than the Third Circuit litigation. Kelly Frickleton will first explain what inclusive language is and why attorneys should feel compelled to use it. Eddie Grime, playing a devil's advocate role, will lay out an argument for why inclusive language may already be compelled by Rule 8.4G and why applying Rule 8.4G in some cases may survive a First Amendment challenge. Ted Frank will argue why inclusive language should not be within the ambit of Missouri's and Kansas's rules, and why disciplining attorneys for failing to use inclusive language would violate the First Amendment. We'll conclude with audience questions. Thank you. Kelly, I'll let you start.
Okay, thank you. Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really pleased to be invited. When I wrote the article, I really never would have imagined that I would end up in this room, and I'm happy to be here, and I probably wouldn't have done anything different. So I was asked to write the article by the KCMBA's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer. It was an idea that they had had bouncing around, and as you heard, I have an interest in the intersection of law and race, and in particular using sociological academic work to examine how the law operates. And so they sort of pegged me to do it, and I got the research going from there. I started off with the research brief from that officer. And so I understand my role here to be sort of to spark the discussion, which I'm guessing is what my article did in the first place. So for those of you who didn't read it or didn't have a chance to or aren't from Kansas City, the article argues broadly of the sort of from a moral imperative perspective of using language mindfully to challenge lawyers to think about how their use of language in many different professional contexts can impact the listener and might cause harm on an individual or societal level. It cites cases like Plessy, Korematsu, and the Insular cases for the proposition that lawyers in the past have used language that has been harmful to different groups. And that language carries the weights of law, which means more than just a sentence for attorneys to later argue about. It puts into society an idea of how you should think about, look at, and treat people. And it gives credence to use and empower that language for harm. It's really a sociological argument. It acknowledges that language changes over time and evolves. And when I started researching the article from the DE&I perspective, the concept of inclusive language appeared prominently and repeatedly. So I had to dive in and learn what that was. As was stated, the article describes it broadly, and this is an amalgamation of many definitions I found during the research, as a communication style to incorporate phrases and expressions that are inherently welcome. It avoids assumptions that might exclude individuals or groups of people. It has the goal of adopting language that treats everyone equally and creates a sense of belonging. When I looked again in preparing for today, a definition I saw cited often is from the Linguistic Society of America, And they define it as language that acknowledges diversity, conveys respect for all people, is sensitive to differences, and promotes equal opportunities. I interpret all those definitions onto the lawyer as being considerate and mindful of the perspectives of others when communicating due to the inherent social capital that lawyers have. The article cites the preamble of the ethical rules that states part of the lawyer's job is to demonstrate respect for the legal system and those who serve it. Members of the public would be included in that. I argue, how can members of marginalized groups feel empowered and welcome into the legal system without having language that acknowledges their existence and respects it? The preamble goes on to identify the lawyer's job further to further the public's confidence in the rule of law and the justice system. And a similar argument goes with that as far as making it welcoming to everybody, including and especially marginalized groups. So under the umbrella of inclusive language, there are some other broad categories that can be considered as examples. Gender-neutral language, that's using things like members of the jury rather than ladies and gentlemen. If you're speaking to a boardroom of mixed gender, saying, you know, some people use y'all. That's kind of a tricky situation, honestly. Some people think you guys is gender-neutral. That's a tough one. So I think that's somewhere where the discussion of 8.4G could be interesting. Another example is using person-centered or person-first language. And I come to this from the perspective of disabilities in particular, rather than, you know, labeling someone as saying, you know, they're autistic, that's an autistic person, a person with autism, starting from identifying them as a person and their holistic experience rather than from the beginning labeling them based on merely their diagnosis. Other things in that category of disabilities include, you know, if you have someone with a traumatic brain injury, not referring to them as brain dead, or someone in a coma, not referring to them as a vegetable, being more mindful and frankly precise. That's one of the arguments that really appealed to me in the research, was the precision of language. And I think a good example of that is in the immigration context, using descriptors like non-citizen or undocumented as opposed to illegal or alien. Other arguments in favor of the use of inclusive language include sort of the economic DE&I arguments, which I'm not sure how many people are familiar with. You know, the rise of diversity, equity, and inclusion, part of the argument to corporations and big law firms as to why that should be a priority is because the data of companies that do that, that have a more diverse body of employees, do better. They make more money. And it's because people do better work, they're more creative, they're more comfortable, they're more willing to bring their ideas to the table when they feel included. And I think that by, you know, giving up some social capital for those of us that hold a lot of social capital and being thoughtful of bringing others into that as well, it in the end actually encourages Justice Brandeis's idea of more speech as the appropriate remedy. Because you have more people who are comfortable sharing their ideas, you get more open debate. But it's how do we get there is the question. Eddie asked me to come up with some other contextual examples to sort of spark our debate here. Some of these are true things that I've witnessed, that friends have witnessed, and some I just made up. The ABA opinion on the new 8.4G rule talks about the setting of a firm Christmas party, which I think is very interesting. I think that nobody could reasonably argue if you had, say you had mobile banking capabilities for your client trust account, and you're at the Christmas party, and you're in the corner moving money around, and you're not supposed to do that. Just because you're outside of your office, maybe outside of the context of practicing law, I think we all can agree that that would still be an ethical violation. But what if you say something that offends somebody at that party, right? What if you've had a few drinks? There is also an example of using a transgender person's dead name. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that label. It's used to describe the name assigned to a transgender person at birth that they no longer use. In a courtroom or a deposition for a case where the person's identity is not material, or say you're working with a transgender lawyer and you use their dead name, would that be a violation of Rule 8.4G? What if you were at a cocktail party? What if you were talking about a famous transgender person, Caitlyn Jenner? What if you use Caitlyn's former name? How does that work in those settings? Another example I mentioned in the article is when you're on a Zoom meeting and someone lists their pronouns after their name. I don't know how many of you have seen that. That's sort of a common practice in DE&I that's encouraged, and it's encouraged for those of us who identify with the gender binary, like myself, to do that so that those people who do not identify in the gender binary, who need to identify their pronouns to feel safe and to feel identified, feel comfortable doing that. Because again, those of us who hold social capital are giving a little bit of that up. So I have a friend who works at a big defense law firm, and they had an intern, a law clerk, coming in who identified as non-binary and used they, them pronouns. So she changed her email signature to include she, her, in an effort to make her coworker feel more included and feel welcome. She sent about 2 emails before a partner came down and told her that she needed to remove that immediately because it would offend their corporate clients. I think that presents an interesting 8.4G discussion because she's not the one being discriminated against there, right? It's this other person who's not really involved in the discussion at all. A similar example to that, and then I'll wrap up because I know we're short on time, would be, what if you're sitting in your office as an associate and you hear a partner walking by and talking about someone else in your building and using a black scent, which is when non-black people use language and really a vocal tone that basically preys on stereotypes about black people and how they talk. Or what if they were imitating an accent that is not theirs in order to talk about, an immigrant person? How does that play into the factor? And I think we'll learn more about what you have to consider there. So I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Kelly. We'll turn next to Eddie.
Okay, we're going to see where the rubber hits the road with Rule 8.4G. And this is where a PowerPoint would have been great. So bear with me. I want to think for a second, if we can think about the moving parts of a rule like 8.4G. And just to be very clear, we're talking about only Missouri here, because Kansas has not adopted it. They have the old Rule 8.4D, and we'll come back to that later. So what are the moving parts of Rule 8.4G? First, what's the scope? What areas of conduct are we going to cover? And as we'll see later on, this matters when we talk about the constitutional challenges, if we get there. First of all, is it in any conduct related to the practice of law? That's the model rule. Is it in the practice of law, which is a little bit different, and there are the Pennsylvania's rule uses that and gives 3 subcategories, or is it like Missouri, in representing a client? Missouri's rule uses that phrase many, many times. There's no doubt. It almost overuses it. It's very clear that they've tried to limit it to in representing a client. So that's the first thing, the field of conduct in which we're going to apply Rule 8.4. And by the way, I should say, Missouri does not define what they mean by that, but it's pretty clear. I mean, I think it's clear enough for our purposes today. Okay, the next thing is, what's the mens rea? In other words, what does the lawyer, can the lawyer bumble into a mistake here under Rule 8.4G, or do they have to knowingly do so? And so the model rule says the lawyer has to know, or reasonably should know, that the conduct is harassment or discrimination. Now, we'll come to the conduct in a second. That's the third prong. But that's the mens rea. So if you look at this, it's really imposing an objective standard, because you're never going to be able to really prove that the lawyer knew this in a disciplinary proceeding. It's always going to be reasonably should know. Pennsylvania says knowingly, the lawyer knowingly engages in conduct, although that's not as strong of a term as everybody thinks. We may get to that. We may not today. And Missouri says, Missouri, I'm not sure if this is on purpose or not, but we have two different standards depending on whether we're looking at conduct which counts as bias or conduct that counts as harassment. So two different standards. With respect to conduct that counts as bias or discrimination, the lawyer has to do or say something that the lawyer knew or should have known meets the criteria. Okay, so there is that objective standard on the bias side. On the harassment side, there is no requirement listed. That'll be important here in a moment. Okay, now let's move on to the third point, the third moving part of Rule 8.4. What is the conduct we're talking about here? This is really where the rubber meets the road. Okay, I'm not going to spend time to go through the model rule and Pennsylvania versions of what each of these definitions is, because that might take the rest of the time. But Missouri says harassment. That's one of the two things you can do wrong. Harassment, again, or bias or discrimination. Harassment. It's verbal or physical conduct that shows hostility or aversion toward a person based upon, and then we have our long list of protected criteria, sex, race, gender, or gender identity. I won't go through those. Or just, you've seen these listings before. That's the set of criteria here. So I'm going to repeat that. Verbal or physical conduct that shows hostility or aversion, toward a person based on these criteria. Okay, harassment. Notice there's nothing in there that says, well, did they know they were doing it? Should they have known? It just says, if you do it, it's a violation. Okay, discrimination. Missouri, the model rules in the other states have the second category called discrimination. Missouri calls that category bias or prejudice. Missouri says bias or prejudice means words or conduct that the lawyer knew or should have known. So there's the should have known standard. Discriminate against, threaten, intimidate, or denigrate any individual or group. Now, here's where Missouri is interesting. They take a list of examples that other states and Missouri and Kansas have in their code of judicial conduct, because this applies to judges too, which we won't get into here, a different version of this. They bring that into to our rule of professional conduct. So they say examples of manifestation of bias or prejudice include, but are not limited to, epithets, slurs, demeaning nicknames, negative stereotyping, threatening, intimidating, or hostile acts. That's one group. Suggestions of connections between race, ethnicity, or nationality and crime. And that has real teeth. Judge Jones in the Fifth Circuit was investigated on that one several years ago. And irrelevant references to personal characteristics. So all of those things count in the bias or discrimination category. Okay. Now, look, this is not where I go in a brief, but I was in a hurry, so I'm just going to tell you. Merriam-Webster Online defines epithet as a disparaging or abusive word or phrase, and slur is an insulting or disparaging remark or innuendo. Okay, so, and again, those words are used in the rule. Okay, they're used in the rule in Missouri. Okay, let's go back now, and I'm just going to kind of state my position. I'm not going to really argue it based on our time here, but let's just Let's use some of the examples of Chinese wall. That was an example that was given referring to a Chinese wall. Using the word master, I just heard an example of this the other day that you should not use the word master. And then this is the one I want to focus on the most, failure to use preferred pronouns. There is a Sixth Circuit case that Mr. Frank mentioned to me the other day that I looked up that actually considers this in a different context. Okay, so I'm going to run through a couple of scenarios. In the courtroom or in a proceeding before a tribunal, if you use let's say you fail to use a witness's preferred pronouns, I'm going to say, yes, you have exhibited harassment under Rule 8.4G, because somebody could objectively decide, OCDC here could decide, that you have shown hostility, or maybe not even hostility, just aversion. You've showed aversion to a person based on protected criteria, the protected criteria of gender identity. You may not feel aversion, or you may feel it but not be aware that you feel it. Remember, we talk about implicit bias sometimes too. But you may well have shown aversion by using a dead name or using a pronoun that is not preferred. So that could be harassment. And I'm going to say that let's say that there is no rule in that courtroom. I think there's an argument that you could say that the courts have a heightened power within the courtroom in court proceedings to uphold the administration of justice and control the courtroom. And it's possible that you could be found guilty of an 8.4G violation, and that would survive constitutional scrutiny under the NIFLA versus Becerra case, which I bet Mr. Frank will talk more about it. I'd like to, I can't. Okay, the second area, the courtroom maybe seems easier. How about in the client relationship? Okay, you're talking to a client in your office, and you're not ever going to be in court because you are working with Karen Donnelly and you're forming up a new nonprofit. And you fail to use that client's preferred pronoun. Does it show you can use the same argument I just made for the courtroom. You can argue it is a violation of Rule 8.4G already. And you could once again argue, although the argument's a little bit weaker because we're not in the courtroom anymore, but we're still in the attorney-client relationship. My own view is that once we move out of that, we go into the law firm and to bar activities, the CLE here today, it's outside of the scope of the Missouri rule. So I don't think it can under the Missouri rule. The final thing I'll say is this. You know, Kelly mentioned a lot of, kind of sociological studies and articles. And, don't be too willing to say, well, that's in a journal somewhere. That becomes the lore of the profession. And in another ethics, I'm sure somewhere else we've talked about that as a cabin on Rule 8.4D, that sometimes courts will say Rule 8.4D, which punishes conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, is not too vague because it's really cabined by what we've always understood is just improper conduct that really messes with our justice system. Well, where do we get those conclusions? If you go and read those cases, courts ultimately are sort of enforcing cultural norms. And so as cultural norms change, as lawyers change, and as clients themselves change, it is that's where the rules of professional conduct sink into our society and our culture. As our culture changes, what can violate Rule 8.4G can change. That's the argument, and that will survive First Amendment scrutiny. Bare bones argument. I now turn it over to Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Eddie. Ed?
Thank you. And thank the Federalist Society for setting this up and my co-panelists for joining us today. I bet a friend that I could give this talk without using the word woke once, so let's see if I can keep that up. Texas versus Johnson says, if there's a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive, or disagreeable. So I could end the talk there, but I promised the Federalist Society 15 minutes. Let me start with a historical example of inclusive language. At the beginning of the 20th century, the technical, legal, scientific term for a certain genetic condition was feeble-minded. In 1927, Buck v. Bell infamously upheld a sterilization law aimed at the feeble-minded. And I would suggest today that the problem with Buck v. Bell was not that it used harmful language. The problem with Plessy, the problem with Korematsu, is not harmful language, but bad law, bad legal reasoning. And to attack those cases based on their harmful language, I think, misses the forest for the trees. But science got more inclusive, and in 1910, a psychologist decided to create a neologism for feeble-minded that would be more scientifically neutral, that wouldn't have those negative connotations. And he drew upon his knowledge of ancient Greek, and he invented a new word, never before used, that he thought would fairly classify the feeble-minded without insult. Anybody know what it was? Moron. And you laugh, but in 1910, that was a perfectly neutral word with no negative connotations, and of course, that didn't last. It quickly entered the vernacular as a term of colloquial invective. And by the 1960s, there was a move to replace words like moron and imbecile and idiot, which were in the scientific literature, with a new word. And that word I can't even use as an insult today because I would get canceled, the R word. And in your CLE package, in fact, there's a 1963 article that I included, nice, short, outdated article, where a scientist complains that when people use the term mildly retarded or severely retarded, it doesn't carry the nuance of a scientific term like idiot. But again, the words changed, but the meaning caught up. People now attributed the negative connotations to the new word. And I would suggest that that's going to keep happening. Whatever word we're using today to describe people with mental disabilities, or a person with mental disabilities, this person-centered concept, when we keep using the word person to describe negative things, what's going to happen is 60 years from now, person is going to be an insult. You called me a person. You're implying that I have these negative connotations. And Steven Pinker calls this the euphemism treadmill. The problem is not that the language is repugnant, but that the general public views the condition as repugnant. Trying to change the language might work temporarily, succeed, but it's the tail wagging the dog. The concept will always trump the language in the long term. Give a concept a new name, and it will not purify the concept, but it will taint the new word. And the title of the program is, Do Words Matter? And my answer is, yes, by God, words matter. And 2 centuries ago, I might have been prosecuted for blasphemy for saying that. Ms. Frickleton's article suggests that lawyers have a responsibility to use the word non-citizen instead of alien. And the reason I oppose that is because words matter. An alien is a non-citizen, but a non-citizen, like a resident national, is not an alien. Non-citizen is using an extra syllable to be less precise. And as a lawyer, precision is our bread and butter. No offense to the vegans or gluten-sensitive among you. Policing inclusive language, I think, is the opposite of inclusive. It's a way for the in-group to arbitrarily distinguish themselves from the out-group by inventing new jargon that only the in-group know, while the out-group is held back by their understanding of vernacular terms like master or field or criminal that have been in incontroversial use for decades or centuries. You have to have the privilege of wealth to have time to be versed in the highbrow leftist theory to keep up with the changing mores. Heaven help you if you spent your time studying economics or science or something that would help your future clients instead of grievance studies. And you certainly have no hope if you're just a working class stiff. It creates a lot of work and income for HR officials and the diversity, inclusion, and equity DEI training industry. But virtually all of that is deadweight loss. 97% of Hispanics in a poll said they don't like the term Latinx, the inclusive term for them. They don't know that they're supposed to be offended when they're called something else. And I would suggest trying to train them to be offended would be counterproductive for everyone involved. A spectacular example of the arbitrariness of inclusive language sometimes is the phrase sexual preference. It's a synonym for sexual orientation, at least that's what the dictionary said for decades. You can find thousands of examples of its use. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2017, Joe Biden in May 2020, a gay rights advocate used the term in a September 2020 interview of the gay rights magazine, The Advocate. And now comes the confirmation hearing of Amy Coney Barrett. On October 13th, 2020, now Justice Barrett used the phrase sexual preference in passing in a discussion of constitutional law, and overnight the phrase was now, in the words of Senator Hirono, offensive and outdated, non-inclusive, if you will. Out of Orwell, Merriam-Webster changed its entry overnight. We've always been at war with East Asia. And this is not inclusivity, it's Calvin Ball. Folk etymology is enough to declare a word non-inclusive. USC has stopped using the term fieldwork. Realtors banned the term master bedroom. And the legal term Chinese wall, a historical reference to a people's great achievement, is somehow considered racist. And in practice, this game of Calvin Ball is exclusively weaponized against the right wing. And the arbitrariness of that process demonstrates why any attempt to legislate inclusivity as a disciplinary measure would create constitutional problems, void for vagueness, content regulation, and impermissibly chill First Amendment rights. And I would suggest that that's actually the point, the real point, to silence the right, to silence conservatives. And indeed, comment 4 of the ABA Rule 8.4G makes it clear that this is their real motivation when it comes to chilling speech, because they create an exception. Lawyers may engage in conduct undertaken to promote diversity and inclusion without violating this rule. So if somebody says something non-inclusive, but it's to promote diversity and inclusion, it's okay. One side of the debate, you have an affirmative defense. I said something that offended Christians, but I was just doing it to promote diversity and inclusion. And that's why we were able to succeed when we challenged Pennsylvania's adoption of a version of 8.4G. 8.4G purports to ban discrimination and harassment, but describes harassment to include derogatory or demeaning verbal conduct. But that's speech that's protected by the First Amendment. Things well over the line of polite behavior, such as hate speech and racial slurs, cannot be punished just because they're over the line of polite behavior. There's no categorical harassment exception to the First Amendment. There's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment. Now, it's actionable if you create a severe or pervasive, hostile environment in the employment workplace. You can punish conduct that interferes with the administration of justice. But going to the holiday party, to use the inclusive term, I heard Christmas party. But there's no such limitation to harassment in the ABA rule. A single comment construed as harassing, demeaning, or derogatory can lead to discipline. And the ABA doesn't limit its rule to judicial proceedings or the administration of justice, like Missouri does to the representation of clients. And so you can see the problem. One can imagine any number of political positions where taking that position is derogatory or demeaning. Taking a position on transgender people in athletic competition or military service. Affirmative action, crime and punishment, Obergefell, Bostock, even debates about judicial confirmations, somebody can try to cancel you or complain that you're not being inclusive by taking one side of that debate. And combined with a thumb on the scale in speech supporting diversity, the reality is that a rule like Model Rule 8.4G would be weaponized. The threat of complaints from political opponents, dragging an attorney into disciplinary proceedings, and worse, publicity about disciplinary proceedings would chill speech. And when I speak about weaponization, it's not hypothetical. We heard the mention of Fifth Circuit Judge Edith Jones, who gave a speech in 2013 to the Penn Law School Federalist Society. And in the course of answering audience questions, She mentioned in passing, she made an empirical observation that members of some racial groups commit crimes at rates disproportionate to their population, and thus it's not surprising that you end up with a disproportionate number of that racial group on Capitol Row. And in response to that, organizations, activists, and law professors supported by the affidavits of five University of Pennsylvania law students and an attorney who had attended the lecture, filed an ethics complaint against Judge Jones for racial bias on the basis of her speech. And after appointing a law professor to investigate, a three-judge special committee of the D.C. Circuit, which had taken over the disciplinary proceedings from the Fifth Circuit, rejected the complaint in a 71-page single-spaced report. The complainants appealed, and a year later they lost again. But the process is the punishment. Judge Jones faced extensive adverse publicity and investigation for nearly 2 years, and even today, if you look at Judge Jones's Wikipedia entry, this is a woman who served over 35 years as a highly respected federal judge, several landmark opinions, should have been on the Supreme Court, and this baseless, silly ethics complaint is the largest section of her Wikipedia page. And maybe somebody here will be inspired to fix that. Northwestern professor, Laura Kipnis, no conservative, wrote a Chronicle of Higher Education essay where she criticized Title IX policies on sexual misconduct for putting professors and accused students in untenable positions. And in retaliation, two graduate students filed a Title IX complaint against her for creating a hostile environment. And then when Professor Kipnis wrote about that complaint, they filed a second Title IX complaint for her writing about that. Turtles all the way down. She was eventually cleared of wrongdoing, but she faced years of investigation and non-trivial costs to herself and her reputation. And 8.4G calls all of this harassment. It doesn't distinguish between Harvey Weinstein and the neutral recitation of facts by Judge Jones. So, though there's a move to push for adoption of 8.4G and 8.4G-like rules, most states to consider it have rejected it, with even state AGs saying it's unconstitutional or severely limited it like Missouri did. Pennsylvania went forward anyway in the name of inclusivity. My organization sued on behalf of Pennsylvania attorney and won. And Pennsylvania's rule differs a bit because it forbids words or conduct that manifest bias or prejudice, but that's its own problem. Who knows what that covers? In 2020, Senator Markey tweeted, "Originalism is racist. Originalism is just a fancy word for discrimination. So if you're speaking in favor of originalism, are you manifesting bias or prejudice?" Well, Senator Markey would say so, and I suspect there are law students and law professors who would also say that. It's not true, but that's the underlying problem when you create these vague standards. And Pennsylvania engaging in vague content policing, we sued on that as simply unconstitutional. That's what the lower court found in Greenberg. And we optimistically hope that the Third Circuit will affirm on Pennsylvania's appeal. So fine, be polite and courteous to your clients and adversaries in court. That's common sense. And I think in-court behavior can be policed. Basic contempt of court issues, no problem there. But attempting to legislate this in everyday contexts where it does not interfere with the administration of justice would be unconstitutional. Thank you.
Ted, thank you very much to all of our panelists today. I'd like to open the floor to questions. If you would like to step up and come to a microphone, we'd be happy to take any audience questions. Oh, I'm sorry. There's a mic in the back. Is that correct? With the green light. I'm following the light now. Okay, green light. There we go.
So the question is, where does the term Christmas and Christmas party lie? I'm not Christian. I find that offensive. Does that violate Rule 8.36? G, I'm sorry.
Well, I'll take that one, because I think I might have said it earlier. Yeah, I mean, 8.4G, if it's said in representing a client, you know, under the Missouri standard, if it does show aversion or hostility to anyone who you know, doesn't celebrate Christmas, then it would violate Rule 8.4G. Although that example may not play out very often in the courtroom or in representing a client, but it could.
I'm Jewish. I don't celebrate Christmas. I don't get offended when somebody tells me Merry Christmas. I recognize that I'm a minority in a majority culture, and people are saying it to wish me a Merry Christmas, to be nice to me. And I don't have to be offended by that. I could choose to be offended. I could make my life miserable by doing that, but why?
I mean, I have nothing further to add. I don't really know that that would come up in a courtroom very often. I think one thing I will add is that with all of these, and as I read the opinion on the rule from the ABA, that context and the totality of the circumstances really, really do matter in examining all of these scenarios. So I'd need to know more.
Thank you. We'll take the next question.
Hi, Scott Proctor. I practiced in Oklahoma, eastern part of the state, for about 3 years. And my practice was primarily focused on tribal matters. And the word Indian is laced throughout the U.S. Code and in the Constitution. So it became natural to refer to Indians, Indian country, all that sort of thing. When I went back east to practice last year, I brought that up in a professional climate, and you would have thought I'd said something quite offensive. So I was wondering, is there sort of a linguistic safe harbor for things that are included, or do you have to kind of dance around the words that the founders and Congress have chosen?
If somebody tries to discipline you for using for quoting language in a statute, we'll take that case for you. But you know your audience. If you're in front of a judge who's going to complain if you use the word Indian, don't provoke them. But that's common sense too.
One thing I'll add in responding to kind of go off of that, there are a couple of other rules here that could come into play besides Rule 8.4G. And so, you may have duties to a client who, wants you to be an effective advocate and maybe tells you not to use some language. And so your duty to the client will trump. Having common sense and advocacy is its own ethical duty as well.
That presents a good point on geographical differences too. Some terms, I think y'all was mentioned earlier. I'm litigating several cases in Texas right now, and y'all is very commonplace. So I think it's getting to know your geographic area and what is socially acceptable there too. Do we have any further questions?
To carry on the comment you just had then, I guess that's the question, because obviously we can stand here and give line drawing examples all day. But where do we draw the lines? That's what a lot of the argument seems to be about. But more than that, who gets to decide and why? And so, I mean, to your point about y'all geographically, I mean, 80% of my civil practice is with Missouri farmers. So if I don't say y'all, I don't know who I'm talking to. And so, I understand, but even then it's contextually appropriate. But if there is a complaint, I mean, you can have a misunderstanding as to context from an opposing counsel or an opposing party in a courtroom and still get a complaint. And then I'm still in front of an OCDC committee that might be composed entirely of KCMBA members that read your article.
And agree with it.
Or of course. I mean, and so that's the next question then, is like at what point, two problems I would posit. One is that the median political proclivities of attorneys as a class certainly is not it doesn't stick to the median political proclivities of Missourians broadly within this state. And so you're already saying, okay, a panel of lawyers gets to decide this, or the body politic in general gets to decide it? Well, we've already said the rule's written by lawyers rather than by the body politic, and now I stick to that standard, even though I may not work in a jurisdiction where that's even the way things are. So, because it often seems this is advocacy building towards a rule. In 20 years, your advocacy, and I'm talking to Ms. Frickleton, obviously, I've got contact here. Your advocacy very well may be codified. So, where's the line there? I mean, that really is a question. Where's the line and who gets to decide and why? As to your opinion on that.
My opinion is that we have to be mindful of the evolving nature of these issues as well, right? Like with that example having to do with Native or Indigenous communities, within marginalized communities, there is debate about what the appropriate terms are. So I don't have a good answer on, you know, this person gets to decide or this person gets to decide. We have to work within the systems that are set up, right?
Right, but you're talking about, I mean, theoretically taking away people's licenses.
Taking away
their livelihood. Well, but a disciplinary committee could.
That's not what I said. I just want to be clear.
Okay, so a disciplinary committee could do that, though. And so there should be a line in between you don't lose your license for these violations or what?
I mean, that's going to have to develop in the jurisprudence of this and working within the systems that we have. And if we believe that the system of having a panel of judicial disciplinary counsel decide issues, whether it be this or whether it be any other issues, that's the system we have. And if we believe that that is truly effective, these will get worked out based on materials that are presented to those people in the way that it would in any courtroom. It's a matter, it's a factual decision.
And just to jump in, there's a textual basis for that in Rule 8.4. Mr. Brent Hayden, who didn't introduce himself to
us. Sorry.
But of course, I don't have the full, I see I didn't print off the entire text, which wasn't very good. But in our comment to Rule 8.4G in Missouri, we say that something similar to what the model rule says about, you know, using context and common sense, or maybe that's in the ABA opinion. And so that would be the answer here. And that sort of goes along with this lore of the profession concept. If the treadmill may go on, and the lore of the profession is created along with that treadmill. And so the argument would be that the 8.4 duties follow a little behind as the lore of the profession is created on that treadmill.
So then specifically, what do you think about like Missouri mudflap as a term, Eddie? Are you on board with that one? Or that's the mullet, the late 80s right. Mullet you see at the Lake of the Ozarks, a Missouri mudflap?
I'm getting there myself.
Okay, but
no, that's a rhetorical question. Okay, Karen.
All right, we have one final question, I believe.
Thank you all very much for coming this morning. I take your point that there are some reasons that we should be more precise or inclusive with our language, but legislating that, making that an official rule is problematic. Is there a way to enforce or at least support a norm of being more precise with attorney and judge language short of the ethical rules that we're discussing?
Ed, would you like to tackle that one? Does it implicate the Constitution as well?
You know, if you think somebody's being imprecise, you can call them out and you will suffer the consequences of that speech if you're calling them out seems silly. And if you're persuasive, somebody might change their position. I would just like to say that, you know, for really egregious cases of discrimination or harassment, the existing rules already handle that. If you're sexually harassing a secretary or a court personnel, existing rules cover that. You don't need an 8.4G sanctioning bias or prejudice in the everyday context, because the only thing that's addressing is the marginal case that really creates the problem of the line drawing, creates the problem of what's going to turn out to be inconsistent enforcement and one-sided enforcement.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you to all of our panelists today, and I will turn the mic over to... Well.